Lagash. Lagash is the patron city state of Ninurta. Ninurta, being the second in line after King Anu, he's literally number two in line on Earth Colony. And his father Enlil is the Earth Colony commander. Ninurta, and Enlil is the crown prince, of course, under King Anu. And Ninurta, being the son of Enlil and grandson to the king, puts him third in line, second behind Enlil, the father. So Ninurta's got a very important position, very important. And Nozera's kingship continues under the double seed law. What's the double seed law? Sorry. It's the Anunnaki from Nibiru. It comes from them. In order to have a legal heir to the throne, an undisputed heir, the heir has to be born of you plus your sister. If you don't have a sister, then it's you plus your half-sister. If you don't have a half-sister, then it's you plus your first cousin. Now, and if you don't have that either, you don't have an heir. And the double seed law of succession to the kingship means you need to be born of the double seed, meaning it's the double DNA of the same forefather. So if, for instance, the first 10 generations in Genesis, from Adam down to Noah, they all married their sister or their half-sister. If they didn't have that, they married their first cousin. In the case of the last one, Noah, he married his first cousin. He didn't have the other two. So by doing that and having a male, you are producing an heir of by law of succession of the double seed. Because simply the father is the same as the sister. It's the same bloodline, and you're getting literally the same bloodline they have, unaltered, undiluted, and therefore all the advantages they have of being bigger, taller, stronger, smarter, faster, and live much longer than the Earthlings, all those advantages they just passed on to their son and heir. And everyone who was born with the blood of the gods tried to hang on to their bloodline and not dilute it away. And if their sister was also born of the gods, then you have a great chance of producing an heir of the double seed. The next 10 generations from Noah down to Abraham, they did the exact same thing. For example, the last one, Abraham, he married his sister, Sarah. And he produced no heirs with Sarah. Sarah's frustrated, can't do anything for him producing heirs. And that's a bad deal for Abraham. So she hands Abraham one of her servant girls, and as a concubine, he produces a male. And this male they called Ishmael. And Abraham's big on Ishmael. He's living him up, boy. And he turns about 10 when all of a sudden Sarah, who is 100 years old now, becomes pregnant. And because they are semi-divine, they have They live longer, they're bigger, taller, stronger, faster, smarter, live longer, and therefore they're the leaders over the earthlings. Anyway, Abraham's got his sister Sarah, and again produces the heir through her, named Isaac, or Isaac. As soon as Isaac is born, Sarah, the spouse and mother to Isaac, says, Ishmael, you and your mother have to leave. Leave the city and don't come back. And they were heartbroken waiting for Abraham to stop it, but he can't because the new heir from the double seed takes over, and Ishmael is totally out of this. That's what happened to Enki and his brother Enlil, who is much younger, Enki being much wiser, Enlil being much younger. Enki's heir, Marduk, thought Enki got screwed. So Marduk's thinking his father should have been heir to the king, Anu, not Enlil, and then Ninurta. He's thinking it should have been Enki and then him. So bad blood between Marduk and others on Enki's side rises like crazy against Enlil's side under Ninurta and his brothers and others. And they're just battling each other like crazy. And then after gods fight gods, they decide to have your loyal earthlings get attacked by my loyal earthlings. So now we're overthrowing each other's city-states, and the earthling has learned to kill each other pretty efficiently. And, you know, weapons handed by the gods and all that technology. And Anna wants to make sure her army doesn't lose. Marduk wants to make sure his army doesn't lose. And so they help each other's army out. And Anna, who is Enlil's granddaughter, she would literally fly at the front of the charge. So here she is given Air Force first wave of attack and knocking down defenses and walls and what have you so that the king can attack through these torn down defenses and overcome the city-state, which somewhat guarantees her loyal king victory over that nasty disloyal king in that city-state. So Marduk and her, and Marduk and Ninurta, and so on and so forth. Marduk's sons and brothers against Ninurta's brothers and others. And one of them being a girl, Inanna, who is the goddess of love and war. She loves war. So as we come to Lagash artifacts, you can hit refresh the page and the slideshow begins again from the beginning. And the first two slides that come up are two maps, 2AA, and this other one is 2A. Put your cursor on the first one. When you do that, the slideshow pauses. And you can hold it in that pause mode as long as you keep the cursor there. But when you put the cursor there, a brief description pops up. Sometimes that description gets in the way of you viewing that artifact or picture. So to get rid of the description and view the slide, just put the cursor on the slide that you don't want to view at that time. For instance, we want to view 2A. Put your cursor on 2AA, which is the first one, and we're going to view the second one. You can see the Arabian Desert where the Persian Gulf is, and those rivers emptying into the Persian Gulf. It's Euphrates and Tigris. At one time, there was an ancient river just south or to the left of the Euphrates on this map, and another ancient river to the right of the Tigris. All four of these rivers dumped into the Persian Gulf. And between those rivers is the fertile valley, the fertile lands between the rivers. Five books or Genesis through the Torah or the Old Testament or whatever you care to call it. In that book of Moses' book, Genesis, the beginning, it all started right there. And you're looking at the first city-states on Earth. So as we look at, it says Mesopotamia, and under that says Sumer. And under Sumer is the first civilization. Man literally, evolution time, man literally went from being a caveman to Homo sapien, living in cities and having all the sophistication of a citizen in a city. These cities have what we have in cities without the technology. So as we look at this, you'll see Lagash down there on the south end of the Tigris, the bottom end of the Tigris going into the Persian Gulf. You can see it's one of the early city-states that was established. And, of course, it's established for the Earth colony commander, Enlil, Sun and Air, Ninurta. So, of course, he's got his own city. Or should I say, these are where the ziggurat houses are that these guys live in. And below these large pyramid shaped ziggurat houses, cities begin to, earthlings gather and form cities. And as they sit there below that temple, overpowering temple, and they see that god living there, they're loyal to that god. And if they're not, they're going, not like what happens. Any king that tries to go against the god, he's all of a sudden either missing or sick and dying, or something very bad. Don't go against the gods. You lose your power quick. So you're looking at the Garden of Eden, so to speak. And what the these Anunnaki human-like beings, we look exactly like them, who came down, had sex with the daughters of man, produced children, and those children became the first kings. And what would happen is the gods living in these cities, which are their cities, with their house in it, their residence, and the earthlings gather and they go, well, since we have had sex with them, we now have what's half us and half them. And in doing so, this new creature, this new race of humans, is not blessed by Enlil, first of all. And it's fashioned by Enki and Ninhursag way down there in a place called Eridu, which is by Ur at the very bottom of the Persian Gulf. It, too, is one of the very first cities. Anyway, that's where Enki lives. So Enki and his sister work with Homo erectus. Homo erectus is all of a sudden Homo sapien. Evolution just skipped a million years of man's evolution is missing. They call it the missing link. And it's missing because man was modified by Enki and then Herzog, and Sun Ningazita helped. But they produced all kinds of creatures in their attempt to find workers. They're simply looking for worker replacements. That's all. Because 300 of them are stuck in South Africa mining gold and other things. And that gold is needed to fix their hole that they put in their atmosphere due to all the wars they had becoming a one world order. So somebody needs to repair that because they're losing atmosphere and the planet will die with it. They will too. So gotta find gold. It's not on their planet. They search the solar system and the only place they can find it is on the asteroid belt. And trying to do that, they get killed. So they need to find gold. One guy, one king, who does nothing finding gold, this prince kills him and tries to usurp the power and say, I'm going to save this planet and we're going to find gold. Anyway, he has to flee. He grabs his flying saucer and he goes where they don't go, which is on the inside of the asteroid belt where Earth is and Venus and Mercury. So they don't fly in there because the asteroid belt is too dangerous and they would have to fly through it. Well, that one guy, that one prince flew through it, landed, says there's gold here, radios back, and King Anu, who is now king, sends his most trusted eldest and wisest son, Enki, with 50 of them. They come down, land in the Persian Gulf. They put on their fishy suit, which is simply a wetsuit, and they wade into shore. Waiting at shore is Alalu. You can see this on Alalu artifacts. And he's by the way, Alalu is Enki's father-in-law. And he's just sitting there waiting for Enki to arrive. And when he does, it's, hey, look at this. We've got fruit on tree, you know. We've got sweet water. We've got great land, fantastic soil. We got good sun. We got everything that's needed to sustain their life while they gather gold. So 300's mining gold under Enki supervision. 300 is in the Garden of Eden. And when that gold is gathered in rock form, they ship it up to Enlil in the Garden of Eden, where Gibel, the god of metallurgy, he's the god of the kilns, and he'll smelt it and bring it down to just pure gold. When they get enough pure gold, they'll load it and blast off of out of Sumer, and they'll send it to Mars, where they will drop it off, and it will be stored. In the very beginning, it was Marduk running Mars operation. It would be stored on Mars as a way station going to their planet. So warehouses need to be built and pyramids, you know, residences built and so on and so forth on Mars. And these things have pretty much been discovered and photographed by our probes. So there's evidence of life on Mars. We're talking about it here because Marduk was the one setting up the way station. And so you got 300 truckers and or guys stationed on Mars. And their job is to go get whatever is ready to be from Earth sent to their planet, Nibiru. Go get it, load it, and blast off. Go to Mars with it, unload it, store it in warehouses until their planet flies by. And their planet flies by just on the outside of the asteroid belt. If you look at the Nibiru page, you would learn all about this. So as it's flying by, it's real close to Mars. Mars has less gravity than Earth. It's a simple blast off with a heavy load of gold and dump it off on the home planet. and then pick up the supplies and whatever else is needed. At one time, that was sheep and seeds and so forth. Sheep, they like to eat. It's not native to Earth, so they brought it down, as well as other things, supplies and equipment for mining and digging canals and so on and so forth. It's a lot of heavy work. The Garden of Eden, you're talking about building farms, irrigating farms, setting up housing, setting up schools, setting up clothing manufacturing and repairs and medical and everything in a city needs to be set up. They know how to set up cities. And then they would give basically each city to one of the gods who is living about 50 miles apart from each other, as you can see on the map. And they do it, they build these things along the river, which is another way of navigation for these guys. They've got the space flight for long travel between Earth and other planets. They've got that vehicle. They've got the other vehicles just for hanging around Earth's atmosphere for travel. And they've got many others, whatever they need. And they have satellites up there for their communication back home to their planet. And all this stuff that you may see today, we learned it from them because they had already set it up right there in Sumer. So we're going to look at Lagash's artifacts that are here in Sumer. You've got 300 mine and 300 there in Sumer, and this is only the gods, and 300 space truckers / Mars. They get tired of doing the work. I mean, especially the guys in the mines. Inky's group just gets tired as hell of no sun, poor air, and you know, that mining's dirty work. So after many thousand years, our years, it takes 3,600 times for us to go around the Earth to equal one time for their planet to go around, for us to go around the sun, equal one time for their planet to orbit around the sun, same sun. They have a very elongated orbit. You'll see that on the Nibiru page. Anyway, it takes a long time, and therefore there's a lot of needs that build up. Within 3,600 years, they've only aged 1 year. Earthlings go, these guys are immortal. I mean, they live forever, right? And their mixed breed offspring are semi-giant, semi-immortal, semi. But still way ahead of the earthling. So these become very good workers. And now all of a sudden these guys got replacement workers and everybody wants them. And they got to multiply fast. So Adam sits in the Garden of Eden and he's supposed to multiply fast and live long to do it. And he does so. And the next nine generations do the same thing. If you look at the biblical text, you'll see they all live 1,000 years and have 1,000 kids. Plus they have an heir. And they all married their sister, half-sister, okay? So it's the exact same customs for the exact same purpose that the demigods are imitating the gods. And then the earthlings end up imitating the demigods. And then Noah's flood comes and it's supposed to eliminate the demigods. And they can start over with only natural beings on Earth, not the unnatural, unclean that Inky's been doing trying to get a worker. So you don't need a half zebra and a half lion to carry the load. They'll never take orders and never do it properly. So finally, Inky takes Homo erectus, modifies him, and he's got somebody who can understand, who can do the work, and it's just wonderful. So there's a worker race of beings, of humans, that now inhabit the earth. And out of that worker race, because there's no women for the gods, there's about 900 of them. The only women around are descendants of the king. They're not going to be available to the normal Anunnaki, who's here working his butt off, and no women. 900, and you got six women or something. And you'll never go out with Anana. It's not going to happen. So anyway, they take, as the Bible says, they take any of these women they want, and they have sex with them, produce children, and these mixed breed children, demigods, they become the heroes of old men of renown, meaning the very first kings. And that's what we're doing here. So there's the cities. Let's go and see what the gods do. There's an aerial view of Lagash. And you can probably see Noah's flood would have a big effect there. To the right, 2B, you're seeing a recreation of what Lagash would actually look like in its heyday. And then you'll, of course, see the step pyramid where Ninurta lives. Now, Ninurta has a spouse, which happens to be the very King Anu's daughter. Ninurta marries his aunt, the daughter to the king. He's the grandson to the king. They produce an heir. I guarantee you it's of the double seed. See what I'm saying? So Ninurta's second behind the king, and he and Bo, which is the king's daughter, his spouse, when they have an heir, that guy is third behind the king. So Ninurta's a shoe-in, and his heir with Bo is a shoe-in for the double seed law of succession. And all this time, Marduk is going crazy saying, Dad, you got screwed, and therefore I'm screwed, and we're not going to put up with it. They're not capable of handling this big job, and so on and so forth. You hear that all the time between one group of politicians against another. Same thing. Okay, on down the line, you're going to see another drawing of Lagash, which is the largest city of its day. So the description pops up, and that's a brick-built city. Every one of those are mud bricks about the size of your foot. They are that fertile soil there, mixed with straw and whatever else they do. And they would make those bricks quickly and use thousands to do it. And you can see it takes millions of bricks to build all that with just a brick the size of your foot. Takes a long time and millions of bricks. So, and that's a lot of labor. Oh my God, that's a lot of labor. And that ziggurat house holds God. That's the temple. You see that stairway? That's the stairway to heaven where the God lives. And if you're down on the ground, you look up that stairway, all you see is the sky. So as far as you know, that stairway goes straight into heaven. That's how it looks to a primitive modern man. Anyway, as we leave the drawings, we go into Lagash for real, and you're looking at some of the mud bricks, as the archaeologists start cleaning the place out so they can see what's there under the mud. All this is buried. Now, how much mud does it take to bury that pyramid? And how would you get it up there? These are good questions, if you ask me. So as we go on down here, you're starting to see here's an artifact that does this, commemorating this event. So important that they make these artifacts. And if you look closely at these artifacts, there's cuneiform writing below these things, these buzzards eating flesh. It's the Tablet of the Vultures, which is a Lagash artifact, and it's about this king and the people he's killing. So, my king against your king, and so it goes. And, of course, my cousin, were fighting. My son, though, he's got his king, so my king and his king are allies. You see, now you've got a series of allies and you've got a series of multi-location enemies. And they brought that stuff to Earth. As a matter of fact, they say kingship was brought to Earth by Enlil, because Enlil had to approve kingship to ever reach these mixed breeds and then these Earthlings. But you had to have some kind of order, and they definitely wanted a go-between to keep a buffer between the Earthlings and the gods who live way up there in the Step Pyramid, keeping themselves safe from a primitive modern man. Okay, next is, you see, one of these contraptions where you've got two different beings trying to create a worker. One's a lion sphinx, and the other one looks like a bull sphinx. I don't know what to say. The bull is usually a dad. A male lion, you got me. Okay, next is item number four, is a rations tablet. So, I mean, they're watching, they're keeping records of everything. All the crops, how it does, and so forth. They're also keeping records of what the gods are doing. That's important. The gods recreate the scene in these rock carvings or these wet clay impressions. And some of these are cliff carvings. So anyway, all these stone carvings last thousands of years. And thank God they discovered them starting around the mid-1860s, biblical archaeologists, trying to prove if the cities in the Old Testament exist, then maybe the stories are true. Therefore, you see what I'm saying? So here they are, and they're digging these things up, like that tablet and like this basin. Look at 5A. I believe that's a water basin. And on that is the goddess with jugs of flowing water. You got to carry the water wherever you go if you want to drink. Somebody's got to carry it. Somebody's got to go get it when it's empty. And there's a water basin with the goddesses taking care of the water. Now, you see those goddess, I believe that's two or three different goddesses. And if you take a look at their headgear, that's a crown of animal horns. And it looks like they have, these goddesses have one layer crown of animal horns. It's letting you know they are, in one way or another, a blood relative to the king. That's a royal crown. Only royal bloodline descendants get to wear that. Okay, they're regular. Anunnaki has no crown of animal horns, and that's an earth thing. Okay, next slide is kind of a blow up of that water basin, and you can see this particular goddess, and they're passing the water down. Next one is another artifact, clay prism, and cuneiform sketched onto there. Now, these carvings under these rocks, it's hard to believe that early man could have done these, and early man did not know how to read and write. He had to be taught. The first scribe was Nisaba, who is one of the original goddesses who came down. They call her the goddess of grain. And there are many artifacts about her, and I definitely recommend you check her out. You'll find her on the 47 minor gods slides. Nisaba. Anyway, here we're looking at these artifacts discovered in Lagash as they go through these towns and start digging out the mud. Now, artifact 5, to the left of that, you see a stone, a small stone of different types of minerals. And that stone would be carved and shaped into a very smooth cylinder. And then they would reverse carve on this very small cylinder stone. They would reverse carve a negative image. Then they would take wet clay and they just roll that thing, which is cylinder seal. And they would just roll that cylinder seal on that wet clay, and out comes a positive image. And now you're looking at a very detailed positive image that had to be reverse carved on a small stone. And come up with the idea that we can create a printing press in ancient days by creating that stone and rolling it on clay. We can send this scene, which is so important that we made an artifact to save that scene for all times. And there may be a text that goes with that artifact, but we don't know what it would be, and haven't put them together. Some of these I have, but many texts I don't have, because they're not relative to the gods. I don't care about the inventory of grain and things like that. How they're mad at the other guy. All I want to know is pertaining to the gods, what happened to the king. Pertaining to the gods, what happened before the kings existed. So you're looking at a nice artifact on a Lagash cylinder seal. And it looks like you've got a male and a female in there, and you've got somebody waiting on them hand and foot. And I can't tell if on the bottom scene, if that's a mine or what that is. But you can tell there's a god seated there, and he's holding a royal scepter, so you can imagine that's Marty claiming to be supreme god over all the others, or it's probably Enlil, who actually has the supremacy, or the crown prince Ninurta. So Marty is the imposter, and Enlil's family just won't put up with this. So war comes along, and number 6 is an offering to Ninurta, and you can see the guy on the right is like a primitive Nephilim giant. He's a mixed breed giant appointed the kingship as a go-between. And as you look at them, This guy probably has no hair whatsoever, a little bit chubby, and he's acting as king and high priest, both. That's what this depicts if he's sitting there with no hair. The high priest, a lot of times, most always, has no hair, and they keep him clean because they don't want him bringing anything, diseases or parasites or anything, from down there in the soil up to where the gods live. And there may be the local god that resides there, and there may be smaller temples for his brothers and what have you, children, to come visit him. And they've got their own private little hotel. And these mud brick structures get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the city grows bigger and bigger. Okay, so you're looking at a giant Nephilim there. You're looking at a bird on top of two lions. That bird is called an Anzud bird. And it's pretty much a symbol of Ninurta's flying saucer. That is a powerful beast. So it's depicted kind of as a flying beast. Okay, Lagash, here you got Gouda, who is 7A. He's a high priest and a king. He's also the sun, directly under the goddess Ninsun. So here you have a goddess having sex with a semi-divine that is made king, and she marries this guy. Ninsun, the goddess, marries Lugalbanda, a Nephilim king of Uruk. And you can find about him in Uruk. There are texts there and so forth. You can learn about Lugalbanda. Anyway, this is one of the sons of Lugalbanda, Gouda. His other two sons became kings as well. But by the time you mix the blood of a goddess plus a demigod, you end up somehow with a two-thirds divine king instead of semi-divine. He's two-thirds divine. So he's a little special, and the gods treat him that way. Okay, more two-thirds divine Gouda, and he's taken care of with artifacts and texts. This is an artifact from there. It looks to me like it could be a priestess. And the priestess, they're there to service the god who's living there, or the god that's visiting there. And they service in different ways if you're female. If you're a male, high priest, You're the acting butler for the alien giant god that lives there. I'm sorry for that. And so the butler is taking care of all the needs of the resident god. And he's taking whatever religious ceremonies or awakenings that the god wishes to bring to the people, the earthlings down below. So up that long stairway will come that high priest. And some of them just live there. And it's very rare not to. For instance, Abraham's father, Terah, lived in one of these ziggurats. He was the high priest. And he lived there with the god, and as acting as butler. So that means he's second most powerful guy in the entire city of Ur, which is the metropolis of all these cities. So Ur is like New York or London. And it's also a high trade center. It has 1 million cows. Go to Ur and you'll see. Go under Nanner's page, you'll see. And Nanner is the patron god of Ur. And many artifacts from Ur, many interesting things. So here we are in Lagash, and that's Ninurta. Ur is Ninurta's brother, Nanner. You see how all these things are related? Because these are descendants of the king. They've got their own special stuff here. And the earthlings are developed to work for them. And then the earthlings become available to them for sex. And they create a new breed, which they turn into either a high priest or a king, always a position of power. And if there's a bunch of those guys running around, it might be a general that they appoint you to. But you'll have a position of power over the earthlings. Okay, next, number 9 is just more of the same. This one is about the destruction of Uma. These artifacts are telling you what's going on, and they give you a little picture to go by. And when you see these little pyramids they're standing on and so forth, that represents a ziggurat. If you see these other things, it could be your stairway into a mine. Keep in mind the work that's being done here. Okay, the next one, number 10, in this black colored thing, is simply an artifact of King Guta in cuneiform script, the first written language on Earth. And I could not tell you if King Guta could read and write. I mean, at what time these Nephilim kings learned to read and write from the gods? Couldn't tell you. Not really sure. And when the earthlings learned to read and write from the king, much, much later. See, when all things pass through that king, and the earthlings are always last. That's the way it is. Next is a priestess, and she's dedicated to Ninurta. And the last one here is a Kopesh. I guess I pronounced that right. That's a sickle sword. Pretty highly advanced. I didn't know Earthling could just produce metal out of nowhere, or even come up with the idea of blending these minerals into metal. And which ones you can forge this way or that way and last forever and so on and so forth. That's a lot to know for a earthling who just came out of the cave and trying to acquaint himself to civilized living. I'm sorry. They could not possibly happen without these alien gods and goddesses to number one, fashion them, present them with a bigger brain, DNA from the gods for all kinds of special effects, like a voice box and the ability to reason and free will. And there's even a passage where it tells you that Enki also put in their spirit. So Enki gave this Adapa model man, Adam, he gave him spirit as well as long life and this and that and this and that. And then later gave him a female so he could reproduce like crazy. They need workers. That's what it was all about. And that's what I'm showing you on my website. It's probably as important as it can be. It is, in fact, your beginning, your genesis, your ancient history, and is well, well documented. Tens of thousands of artifacts depicting scenes of gods, kings, and earthlings. And you can see the difference in sizes and the difference in what appears to be advancements in the human race of this type, that type, or this type. It's very interesting. And it's totally against everything all of us has been taught. These artifacts have been hidden for 2,500 years. We are just now relearning what they are, where they came from, and who did it. And then in the content of the text, who wrote that? These are interesting questions. Okay, the next in this slideshow, you see a double-headed eagle, black and white. It's the symbol of Ninurta. That is the double seed succession law for the aliens. Yeah, it's the law of the double seed succession. And that's what it takes. And whoever's got the most DNA of the leader prior, you know, brother and sister bring you the best DNA from direct line to a king, by far. And the last one here, you see a double-headed eagle with a crown above it. Yes, that's a royal crown, royal prince. There's your royal prince, Ninurta. He's king after his father, Enlil, who is king after his father, Anu. But on Earth colony, Enlil runs it, and Ninurta is next. So you've got one powerful guy, Ninurta, and Enlil that Marty is picking a fight with. So here we're looking at a double-headed eagle, a royal crown, and above that, of course, is the Masonic triangle pyramid with the ruling number 33. So you got a 33rd degree Mason, and it looks like a little face or something in between the 33 degree pyramid and the royal crown. These are all Masonic symbols of the royal of the alien gods related to the king, the royal bloodline of the king, God the Father of them in heaven, Nibiru. So God the Father is king of heaven in Nibiru. His sons and daughters came down to earth to get the gold. And then they had sex eventually with the daughters and sons of men. And what you end up with are a whole new race of beings called the demigods or the Nephilim. It all comes from the gods. All the customs, all the anxiousness, all the jealousy, all of these things and how we respond to them, we learn by watching the gods and copying them. Everything we do is just a rediscovery. And here you're looking at the rediscovery that makes us living at this moment in time very special, because no one's seen this. And there's no one anywhere, no place anywhere on the planet that it's organized like this, that you can see this much of it, and you can get an explanation to what the heck you're looking at. You've seen this stuff before, you just don't know what it is. Masons do, because they maintain these images of the alien gods. And the Masons learned about this when they conquered Jerusalem in, what was it, 1190? The Crusades, and the Knights Templar, as the leaders of the conquering army, they went under the Solomon's Temple, which is still there at the time, and they went under it where nobody goes. Islam forbids, you know, digging up ancient stuff that might cause confusion. So they don't want Islam digging anything. So there it sits for thousands of years, and then comes the knights who come in, dig down in there, and lots of tunnels underneath it, and they discover, I guess, alien artifacts and As you see here, there are things that will tell you simply that this guy's a giant, this guy's bigger, and that's an earthling, primitive as all. And now that they have this information, as well as perhaps the Ark of the Covenant and Solomon's Ring and all types of alien technology, besides the gold and the silver, I mean, they're picking up a lot here. So when they become these Masons, Knights Templars, they become the most powerful entity on Earth. The Pope supports them and pumps enrollment into their ranks. And to become a Knight Templar, you have to forfeit all your belongings to the group Knights Templar. And it goes straight to the Masons. You're a monk, celibate monk, who has no possessions anymore. So all your land and sheep and gold, it now belongs to the Masons, the Knights Templar. And then the Knights Templar, since they're one of the conquering forces that makes Jerusalem, available for everybody in Europe for the first time. So the kings and all the royalty and all the lords and all the wealth, these guys want to go visit Jerusalem. Well, you can't take your wealth with you. And they really didn't have a place to stash it while they are absent for a couple of years making this pilgrimage. So the Masons set up a deal. Bring all your possessions, bring it into us. What's their use of that now? Bring it into us. We'll give you a paper receipt. Or, you know, maybe it's a sheepskin. You're going to get a written receipt. And all you have to do, and that receipt, by the way, in case we get robbed as we're going on down to Jerusalem, Muslims attack us, rob us, kill us, they rob you first, they can't get your wealth. All they got is a piece of parchment that they have no idea what it says, and if they did, it says, you get nothing. And so it is. But if you survive, and by the way, if you die, all that wealth goes to the Templars again. So if you don't quite make it to Jerusalem and back, everything you got on your receipt goes to the Knights Templar. No matter what you do, the Knights Templar get wealthier and wealthier and more powerful. So now that you can drop your wealth off in London, and then you can pick it back up, if you want to, in Jerusalem. The Knights Templar there will give you back whatever sheep you had, whatever gold coins you had, and so on and so forth, other than your property. Now, if you wanted to go on back home, you can't take all that with you, so you drop it off with the Masons. You travel light, so to speak. And when you get home, you cash that receipt and you're back home with your possessions. In theory, it works beautifully. And in reality, it makes them very, very wealthy. So wealthy that they're financing the French king in his war against the English. And they finance the English king and his wars against France. If you need to borrow money, and the Pope had to borrow money many times because he's financing his own Swiss army and building his own, I guess, barricade and palaces and so forth. So it's a mess. Okay. The gods' evidence has been rediscovered. It's listed everywhere on this website. I tell you who they are, what they did, what they look like, what they said and what their offspring kings had to say about the gods. The rest of it I wasn't too interested in. I didn't bring it. So that's what I stick to. And this is the whole point right here. Genesis 6:4. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards. That means they were there a long time. When the sons, that's plural, of God, went to the daughters of men and had children by them. So the Spirit of God produced children? That doesn't make sense. God must have a penis and had sex with the daughters of men and then produced children. Those children, they were the heroes of old, men of renown, the first kings on their recorded records. They're not recording records about an earthling somewhere. They're recording records on themselves and on their demigod offspring that they have appointed an authority over these earthlings. So as far as the gods are concerned, they lay it out to the semi-divine, and the semi-divine, they carry it through with the earthlings. Two different forms of responsibility. King has the most power. High priest has the second most power. And in the case of Ur, that would make Abraham one of the most powerful people in the New York of Sumer. Now let me say that again. That makes Abraham a giant mixed breed who lives long and whose 100-year-old wife, sister, got pregnant, but that makes Abraham one of the most powerful people in the entire city-state of Ur, which is a large metropolis, and it feeds everybody. It feeds the gods, it feeds the demigods, kings, and it feeds the earthlings. And what it's doing is they've got sheep, they've got a million cattle in pens. On their inventory, they come up, I think it was 7 different breeds of cattle. I mean, they know exactly what they're doing thousands of years B.C. Modern man just stepped out of the cave. It's not possible. Now, here's one for you. After reading Genesis, you realize that there were first kings out there. Well, let's talk about them. The second thing down is the Sumerian kings list. I've given you three times, I say, a must read, which I give 3 stars. A 3-star must read means it's got the most information. 2 stars, a little less, and 1 star, a little less, no stars, not much information. When I take a 3-star and repeat it 3 times, I'm telling you it's one of the very most important texts I have here. You've got to read it. It is indeed a must read. When you read the Sumerian King's List, it is an ancient artifact, and I think it's 4 stones, or 4-sided stone. I think it's 4 stones. And this thing is extremely old. And what it's got listed on there are literally every king that's been on earth since the beginning of kingship was introduced by Enlil, so that they had order over the earthlings, workers. But the kingship starts way before the flood. Before the flood. And it tells you who and how long and what they had for a heir and so on. And how the lineage, the king of the king's bloodline, how it passes. So this is a most interesting, and you might even find how the first demigod, giant Nephilim, how long they actually lived in the beginning, and then later how it dwindles. Their life span gets shortened quite a bit because it's way too long, which they needed for these to populate the earth with earthlings that they can use as workers. They can't have enough of them. Keep popping out those babies, please. And that's what they're saying. That's what they're doing. Okay, so as we come down looking at some of these texts on Kings, you see three stars all over the place. That means every one of these are important to read on the Kings. Next is another quote from Genesis. This one's, we're talking about in the first few pages of the book of Moses, Genesis. First few pages of the entire book. And the Lord God said, the man has become like one of us. Who is us? Knowing good and evil, he must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. From the tree of life. He's already now living in the tree of knowledge through this knowing sex, knowing that he's naked, and knowing who God is. That man now has reason and free will and so forth. But who's us? Every religion, somewhere in your original text, they're talking about, we gave you this, it's who, it's us, our, we. This is how they refer to themselves. And they're not referring to angels, because they also refer to angels as angels. When they're saying we and us and our, they're talking about these giant gods that lived about 50 miles apart, who came down from the sky, from heaven, because their father, God the Father, the King, is in heaven, their home planet, Nibiru. And they got to get the gold, set up the colony, and they'd like to go home. But they're here a very, very long time. So we'll go through the Kings now that we know that we're setting up kingship on earth, and he's one of these offsprings of the gods. So here comes Ernina, 2500 BC, 4500 years ago. Now I want you to look at these artifacts. Let's hit refresh and get it started from the beginning. The first one is a pretty primitive statue of the queen of Lagash, Ur-Nina. Okay? Ur-Nanshi is a daughter of Enki. Ur-Nanshi is obviously somebody who's going to be in Ur and named after the goddess Nanshi. Okay, the artifact next to this queen, this Nephilim queen, is you can see skin-headed earthlings, and a couple of them are giants. One is carrying the crop on his head, the bounty, bringing it back, and the other one is seated with a cup of vino. The rest are probably his family members. Let's see, Ur-Nanshi and his family. There you go. Ancient king of Lagash. There's some more of that. The next one, Ur-Nina. Now look how primitive the earthling's looking. Okay, this is 4,500 years ago. And you're looking again at the king and his family. Kind of primitive looking, but definitely a difference in sizes between the earthling and the Nephilim. Then you're looking at a carving here at 3E. And on that is got cuneiform script. I don't think you could reverse carve this kind of stuff and call yourself an earthling. Or even think of a negative image and how to reproduce it. I mean, you're going to invent the copy machine right out of the cave? It's just not possible. There's a million years of evolution that have been skipped, and it does so by DNA modification of this creature called humans that did not exist on Earth when they came. Okay, there's more artifacts here of the king and his family. All look like skinhead primitives. And you can see again on 3F, you've just got a little stone thing of Ur-Nanshi. Now, here's very interesting. The next slide, you see a very nicely laid out detail of a goddess seated, a goddess in the middle, and that goddess is, got a Nephilim king by the arm, or in this case, it might be by the hand. And she's bringing that Nephilim king, who is also a giant, before her mother, the goddess Ningal. That goddess bringing her, bringing the king, is the goddess of love, Inanna. She's going to marry this Nephilim and have him be made king. So again, she's always espousing the main kings throughout history, B.C. Always. She likes being in the action, and since her husband was killed, she's mating and espousing everybody in the Nephilim world that is a powerful king. She doesn't want the minor kings, only the main ones. And therefore, you're also protected by these goddesses that you see there. And off to the right is that God, I can forget this cylinder seal. That cylinder seal, reverse carved image, you can see it rolled on wet clay off to the left there. And that is a very nice, detailed, and well-preserved artifact of, what, 4,500 years? And do you think man reverse carved that scene on that stone? First of all, shape that rock into that cylinder seal, smooth as a whistle, and then reverse carve a negative scene. And then think of a way to imprint that so your positive scene will show up and you can hand a copy off to all the city-states and they know exactly what happened between Inanna and this Nephilim king and Inanna's mother. There may be a text that goes with that, and you've got the whole picture. The scene is preserved because the gods decided for us this scene is so important they're going to go through all this work so that it lasts thousands of years, so that when we finally grow up a little bit, say, and now we're Homo sapiens sapien, maybe as these get rediscovered after 2,500 years, we may start putting them together. The only problem is these things were kept hidden. They've been hidden forever. They don't want man to see this, just like Islam doesn't want us to see it. Christianity at one time didn't want anybody to see it. We are taught lies by those who are in power over us. And imagine just discovering one day everything you've been told is a lie by people who know they're lying. You would be awfully mad. You're taking a look at it. It's right here. You've been lied to, and here's the actual artifacts and the first written language on Earth being presented and preserved for you for thousands of years so that we may wake up and know what our past really is. Okay, here's another artifact, a stone shaped with a carving on both sides of this. And the heavy, overweight girl on the right, that is Nin Herzog, who is responsible with her brother in fashioning these earthlings so that others could have sex with them and produce these Nephilim kings. But she is the one who produced the worker race. And in her text, she would hold up the baby and she would say, "I've done it, I've done it. I've removed the yoke from the backs of the gods and I put it on the earthling. I put it on man. And now man's going to do the work that the gods have had to do for all these thousands of years." And earthlings move into the mine and start doing the work. They move in to the cattle pens and, you know, the sheep herding, all that becomes. And then they move into all these other things. I mean, it's all learned and trained by the gods. And it doesn't matter if you're the Vikings or the Mayans or the Assyrians, Akkadians, Hittites, Egyptians. It doesn't matter. Your civilization started by a giant Nephilim. And the earthlings formed around there. And all of a sudden, your people are organizing as in cities, and they're learning to be civilized, and through much more time learning to read and write and plan and organize and even lay out cities on maps with straight streets and all this stuff. It's amazing what an advanced man could do. And my only complaint is always Nin Herzog gave us a little better back. Because since they removed the yoke from the gods and put it on the backs of man, a lot of men are having bad backs, let me tell you, these days. And I'm sure they did all throughout history, especially working in the mines. Okay, as we go through these artifacts on Ur-Nina or Ur-Nanshi, you're going to see giant-seated servants, earthling servants working on them. These giants might be gods, or they might be the Nephilim. Okay? But they're the giants. It depends on which one we're looking at. The description will pop up. And you got Ur-Nina, and that comes one inscription, no stars, no big deal. Yanatum, he'd be the next king. There's his artifacts rolling by. A lot of war, lots of war. Now, look at artifact 4D. That, again, is one of those cylinder seals reversed. It's carved and rolled on clay. And we're talking, what, Yanatum's 2500 BC. So at the earliest, it's 4,400 years ago. Look at the detail reverse carved on a little bitty stone that was shaped and smoothed. You don't think that primitive sitting there in that picture down below to the right could do that reverse carving, do you? And sketch that cuneiform language in there? I don't think so. And there's more artifacts as they are discovered. 4I and 4J. This is a damaged artifact of Ninurta holding his Anzut bird, meaning his flying saucer with multiple weapons, his fierce flying demon, flying beast. And down below that Anzut bird and his grip on it are earthlings that have been caught in the net being held prisoner. Much smaller earthlings held prisoner as war goes from my earthlings against yours. And let's see. And then we're right back to Ianatum and his army, Ianatum and his family, with cuneiform tax. I just don't think Ianatum did these carvings. I mean, look at them. It's not possible. And he's depicted as fairly primitive, isn't he? Because he is. Okay, he's one of the early kings, those heroes of old, men of renown. Next one is Entemena. And same story, starts off with damaged artifacts with no head. And right on through, you've got the cones with cuneiform writing on them. Now, take a look at that last one, that cone, 5F. That's cuneiform writing. This could be anything, but it could be clay shaped into a cone, okay? Now, that cone, that is simply a model. And it's a model of the command module that sits atop a three-stage rocket. Now, if you go to Ancient Aliens, go to that page and look for some of these flying machines on the Ancient Alien page. You'll see many of them. Well, some of these are three-stage rockets. And just like our three-stage rockets that took us to the moon, you got two stages of fuel getting you blasted and moving you there. And then you eject those and you take the command module and you guide yourself and land on the moon or Mars or wherever you're going. And then that command module will leave Mars and come in and splash down in the ocean, and our Navy will scoop it up. That's what that is a model of 4,500 years ago. How could they know anything about that? They couldn't. Unless they saw it in the sky when there's nothing lit at night. Anything moving in that sky shouldn't be. Nothing moves in that sky. So when they see a flying apparatus, that's a big deal, but they see them. All kinds of them. Okay, next is just other artifacts that are coming up out of here under this king. After Entemena, you got Urukagina, and it's the same thing. You got the family. See the giant skinhead? He's either acting high priest and king, or he's high priest before he becomes king. Something. And then here's another cone. For this one is a proclamation of liberty. Cone with ancient cuneiform, and I'm sure there's a couple scenes on it. I don't have anything on it, or I would have brought it there. Okay, Urukagina, I have very little, nothing starred. Urbo, well, Urbo is the son to a god. I mean, we know who he is, and we know you're talking about a first-generation Nephilim under Ninagal, who had sex with the daughters of man, produced this Nephilim, Urbo, and they appointed him to a position of leadership over the earthlings. Okay? He's a giant, so he's easily identified as your leader. And all this happened in 2000 BC. Now, let's start the slideshow over and try to go through this. Under Urbo, I think there's only two of them. The first one is 7B. What you're looking at there is the great, great God, in my opinion, one of the greatest of them. His name is Ningazita. He is the son to Anu, helper to Enlil and Nin-Hersog in manipulating DNA to produce the worker race of humans. It's all produced, not created, fashioned. DNA manipulation, all of a sudden we're advancing much faster, much, much faster. Okay, and so you can see how many rows of animal horns he has. You can see that he has the long beard, and therefore, since we copy them and everything, you will see the Orthodox Hebrew with a long beard. You will see the those following Islam with long beards. And yes, it used to be you would follow the Christians, a certain sex carried their beards. Now, what Ningazita is doing there is he's laying a foundation peg to a ziggurat. He is the architect of all the pyramids that you see, all of them. He would lay the foundation peg, which is what he's got in his hand there, for this one over here in this city, that one in that city, that one. And he's helping out all the gods by mapping out, surveying out all the plans for their ziggurat and more. He's pretty good at his knowledge and knowing things and doing things. Ningazita is nice to have around. His name was the Egyptians called him the god Thoth, the god of knowledge. He's a smart guy, the son of Enki, and of course Enki's a very smart guy. Okay, the next one is just a tablet of the king Urbo, who is this Nephilim, offspring of the god Ninagal. Okay, we continue. I don't think there's any more there. This time it's Urbo's texts. And there's one. And it's got a one star. Not much information at all. But there's some quotes from a variety of places. And here's one text, which is an inscription. Really not a text. Next is Guda. Guda is the two-thirds divine son to the goddess Ninsun, who married a Nephilim, Langobanda. So the goddess Ninsun, mother, and the Langobanda Nephilim named Langobanda, they are the parents. They have a child, Guda. He's two-thirds divine. He's going to be appointed to a kingship somewhere, guaranteed. And that ends up being in the gash. And, you know, he reigns for quite a while. Different timings on some of this stuff. But Guru was well-protected. Direct son of one of the gods, not a, you know, falling descendant down the tree. This one's fresh, right at the base of the tree. So anyway, if you look at Gouda's slide, you'll see him seated in artifacts. You'll see him standing in artifacts. You won't see any crown of animal horns because he's not a god and he's not born with the king DNA. King Henry's DNA is the only royal god on earth. All his descendants, direct descendants, with his DNA. So there's many artifacts of Gouda because he's very popular and I guess a doer who did many things. And as you scroll through these, there's a fast forward arrow on the right side and a rewind on the left. But one of my favorite artifacts is, if you will, go to 8HH. Put your cursor on one of these two slides to stop it. And when you view that artifact, you see a Nephilim that is a skinhead, and he's being held by the wrist and dragged by Ningazita. And in front of Ningazita is his little brother Dumuzi, and they're headed to see their father, Inki, who is broken, damaged, who would be seated right there in front of them. So if you can imagine, you got a seated Inki and his son, and what's that? His stepson? I mean, you see what I'm saying? They're related through blood one way or another. And also there's another god over here on the far right of that artifact. Now that's a nice carving. Do you think primitive man or even Gouda did that carving? And all of them got nice rows of animal horns. These are no slouches. They're important gods. They're descendants of Inki, who is a descendant of the king, the eldest son of the king. Okay, the next slide, 8H, is a blow-up of it, and you can see Gouda just doesn't, he's not as tall, he's not as fast, he's not as strong, he's not as smart, and he won't live as long as those two gods, his relatives. Okay, next to that is a black and white, and again, you're going to see Gouda and Ningazita, only this time his mother, Nin Herzog, is standing behind him with her hands up and raising, you know, praising him. Oh, I'm so proud of you, son. Look how you have become king. And look how Ningazita drags you before the great god Inki, who is seated there with water flowing out of him. Life-giving waters, and sometimes fish are jumping out of there. So Inki, the god of waters, Greek god Poseidon, is seated probably in his home city-state of Eridu, and his very wise and DNA helping buddy, fashioning that Nephilim right behind him, those two, with Nin Herzog, are responsible for bringing about the Earthling race. And then from the Earthling race came the demigod mixed breeds, and then the flood was supposed to wipe them out, and through time, eventually, they're wiped out. The bloodlines get diluted. You don't see many of them still marrying their sister, trying to keep a bloodline of the gods within your family. A lot of advantages there. If you've got it, you want to keep it. So Nensun's passing it on down. She's got three of these Nephilim's sons that are becoming kings. They become appointed as kings, and all of them have important kingship reigns, bringing laws to the earthlings from the gods. I mean, you see the middleman? Another great artifact, in my opinion, is a Q. Boy, I'd like to own this one. Take a look at that cylinder seal. I'm not sure if that's lapid lazuli, that blue stone, but it's a stone. And again, reverse carved, rolled on wet clay, so all the cities get a copy of the scene that was so important that the gods made this artifact for man to always be aware of this scene. And then in about 300 BC on towards you start to see the gods no longer walking on earth with their offspring demigods, no longer inside their residence, no longer flying around unless you just happen to see them, which many, many people spot these things flying around today. This was thousands of years ago. Look at the detail in this. You would almost say it's a masterpiece artifact. How can that be? So there's the goddess Ninsun, there's her son, a two-thirds divine king, and there's the great god Ningazita, and you can tell because of the snakes coming off of his shoulder. He's the god of the entwined snakes, which is the double helix strand of DNA. You find it on the medical symbol. Every bit of that medical symbol is about that man seated there, that god. Royal crown, that means he's from the royal bloodline of the king. The staff, same thing. The wings means he's capable of flight. The double entwined serpent, or single entwined serpent, depending on how you want him drawn. That's the DNA, that he is a master of manipulation. He and his father and his aunt Ninhursag, they created through fashioning the earthling. And then through the earthling, it got makes which fashioned this thing we call demigods or Nephilim. Some of them lived thousands of years. Some of them lived 120. Just depends. Abraham's sister got pregnant at age 100. Pregnant. So that'll tell you that these demigods have abilities that the earthlings will never have. And that custom continues, I'm sure, to this day. For instance, King Charles of England, his first marriage was to Princess Diana, who was his first cousin. Yeah. Whether people know it or not, he married his first cousin and produced an heir, William. It's the exact same thing. And that is, like, really recent. The King Charles is still king as I make this recording. Now, there's something to this, so please hang with me and come back to this website, visit it often, and spread yourself around because there's much to learn. All of it is just simply the ancient artifact and the translation of an ancient text, the very first written language on earth. All of these are carved one way or another. Carved in the wet clay, carved in the stone. It's a lot of work to do this. They should not be doing it for lies, propaganda, or for no reason, no good reason. I love this. Look at, if you can, under Gouda, go to slide 8P and then stop it from sliding on by. Put your cursor on the other one. And then you got a set of three different Ningazitas laying the foundation peg, probably to three different temples for three different kings. But again, he's the architect. He's the one that he's also the surveyor laying out the foundation stones or the foundation peg so that construction can begin, of which he will oversee, so that all this things that man can't do shows up in these buildings, these structures built by him, designed by him. Mud brick labor probably went to earthlings, you know, but none of this exists, including the pyramids in Egypt, without that guy right there. The very amazing son of the very amazing god, Enki. Pretty amazing stuff. So there's many artifacts of Nengisida, or several, and out of there, it's same story, but you can see how big this foundation peg is in relationship to this huge giant, standing 14 feet tall, maybe 16, this guy. And that Nephilim king is probably around 10. And then the earthling somewhere around 5. Now that makes that god 3 times the size of the earthling. And there are artifacts. Go to Utu's page to see it. But there are many of these carvings, cylinder seals, reverse carvings, of gods in a scene. And Utu's got his foot on an earthling crushing him. Just simply by stepping on him. That guy's dead. They're 3 times the size of the earthling, and I imagine 3.5 times the weight, because they're solid muscle. I guess it has to do with the gravitational force on their planet. All these things are scientifically explained one way or another. Okay. The gas giant, we go right on down. Gudis got all these texts pertaining to him. There is a 3-star, which is Guda is building the Nerta's temple. And whether he's building that from scratch is very debatable, but he's building in Lagash. Something for Ningirsu, and it could be his house, which is the ziggurat. I really believe it'd be more like a repair, a remodeling of his ziggurat, because that ziggurat was built way before earthlings showed up. Okay, and then there's others with a 1-star. Okay, next all I can tell you is go see Ninurta on his page. And check him out closely. He's next, after his father Enlil, to go back to the planet and run that planet plus the colonies, however many of them they have. Well, I want to thank you for coming and viewing this page. I hope it helped you. I hope maybe you picked up something and interest you enough that you might come back again. There's so much here. If you're looking for the hidden truth or answers to all the mysteries that are in the Bible, all the answers are here. All your ancient history has pieces of it here. It just is never presented like this ever in thousands of years. And we didn't even know they were around because they were buried for the last couple thousand years. And it's probably a good thing because they would have been all broken. I strongly suggest some of these, especially the 3-starred texts, take the time, read them. Good information. Good artifacts, lots of nice pictures, and again, who could create these artifacts that far back? Because these kings Well, read the Sumerian Kings list. You'll see what I'm talking about. Thanks again for coming. I mean, I really appreciate it. I do truly hope you're getting a benefit from coming. Otherwise, this is just not for you. Don't spend any more time. This is something you need to want to know this stuff to actually get involved with it. And, Curious Yellow is okay. That qualifies. Come on in, take a look. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Bye.